We are talking once again with Job Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. A busy, busy week.
Yeah, a lot happened this week. And we're not even doing any April Fools, maybe.
No. Please don't. All right. So starting out with Anna Patrick at the Seattle Times reporting that a ballot initiative was filed Monday regarding new housing for the homeless.
Yeah. And this is unlike Charter Amendment 19 last year. This was actually crafted by homeless advocates as opposed to, developers. This is something that would establish a public developer that would be nonprofit, obviously, that would create, own, and maintain public housing in Seattle. The effort is known as social housing, and this is something that's been tried in a number of cities in Europe with some success. Of course, we are not a European city, unfortunately. We don't operate in that environment. But it's essentially a publicly owned housing that's insulated from private market forces, and it's designed to be permanently affordable. We'll see whether people go for this. I don't think the sponsors listed a price tag for this, and of course, the concern is that the developing housing is a very expensive proposition. And, in recent years, Seattle voters have been somewhat tax averse. So we'll see where it goes. But clearly, this is the kind of thing that needed to happen, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, and didn't. But yeah, better late than never, right? So we have some housing that's already in the pipeline, but not nearly enough, given that, we're in the five digits now in terms of people in King County who are homeless. And, of course, we would have an exact number, except that once again this year there was no point-in-time count. And there's an open question as to how accurate those are anyway. But now that the eviction moratorium has expired, or close to, and people are pretending that the pandemic is over, I expect that there will be a wave of additional evictions, and that's inevitably going to result in an increase in homelessness, which is going to strain the system even further. So, good luck to the good luck to the ballot initiative, and we'll see if it gets the signatures to get on the ballot.
One of the other unique aspects of my reading of the article was that what they're proposing would be managed in much closer to a situation like, for instance, that Nicholsville is, in that the people who are actually living within the units will be using the democratic process to make their decisions.
Mm-hmm. So,
which is very different from the top-down structures we have currently in Seattle.
Yeah, it's more of a co-op model than anything else. That has worked well in the past. So we'll see if, that particular facet of it, I don't think is going to determine a lot of votes one way or the other, because people aren't going to get in the weeds that much. So it's one way of getting around, City of Seattle's historic aversion to, doing anything that, allows homeless people to have a say in their own fates.
So moving along, folks in Kirkland appear to be going the opposite direction in terms of potential homeless shelter there.
Yeah. A group in Kirkland who say they represent local parents, and they're calling themselves Keep Kids Safe, which is a really disingenuous title. And, anytime anybody cites save the children, you know it's probably a grifter of some sort. But this is a new group that is suing the city of Kirkland over plans to convert a vacant La Quinta Inn into a homeless shelter. Of course, this is a model that King County has used quite successfully in the wake of the pandemic, you know, buying local hotels and motels. And there was a big brouhaha in, was it Kent or Renton? I think it was Renton.
Where, I was thinking Kent.
Okay.
Kent, but
it somewhere,
could,
somewhere down
could
there.
Could be both.
Yeah, that's true. That the local city council had basically stopped the county from using that particular model to house homeless people. Yeah, this was something that the county wanted to do in Kirkland, and the alleged parents say that the city ignored state and county laws when it purchased the hotel, and that the county should have been required to have a public meeting regarding the intended use of the property. Now, why any of that is relevant to protecting children is anybody's guess. But that is how they're pitching it, which sounds pretty much like a cynical NIMBY PR ploy. But, yeah, they have filed the lawsuit, and that will wind its way through the courts, and we'll see if it gets direction.
I don't think you had a chance to see this one, but Mike Carter wrote in the Seattle Times on Wednesday, the headline was, Washington panel now will consider past offenses when deciding whether to take an officer's badge. Let me to just read a couple quick paragraphs from this.
Sure.
The newly expanded Criminal Justice Training Commission, which is in charge of training and certifying police and jail guards and the like within Washington State, expanded Criminal Justice Training Commission, its membership now including relatives of people who died at the hands of police, on Wednesday voted to increase the commission's ability to take the badges and guns of troubled law enforcement officers, even if the wrongdoing occurred years ago and went unpunished at the time. The commission voted 14-4 in favor of applying the provisions of Senate Bill 5051, passed by the state legislature last year, to all future police decertification actions, regardless of when the misconduct occurred. That means that the new provision, which greatly expands the circumstances when officers can close their badges, can be applied to misconduct that occurred even before the law took effect on July 25th, 2021. Quote, the officers who murdered my son got away with misconduct, said Commissioner Sonia Joseph, the mother of Giovanni Joseph McDade, an unarmed 20-year-old black man who was fatally shot by Kent police in 2017 following an alleged traffic violation.
I remember that.
She settled the lawsuit against the city last year for $4.4 million. The involved officer, William Davis, remains on the force and was not disciplined. Joseph was joined in her support by newly appointed citizen commissioners Annalisa Thomas, whose son Leonard Thomas was killed by Lakewood police in 2013, Trishandra Pickup, whose former partner Stonechild Chief Stick was killed by Paulsboro police in 2019, and Katrina Johnson, whose cousin Charlena Lyles was killed by Seattle police in 2017, and Nikki Hunter, whose brother Carlos Hunter was shot by Vancouver police in 2019. So to me, that really just jumped out as potentially major change, including family members on a commission that is overseeing police trainings, family members of folks who had been killed by police. And I just can't think of a
okay, I'm gonna play devil's advocate here. That sounds to me like giving crime victims a voice in a sentencing commission, which, you know, the people perpetrating the crime in this case are police officers, and it really is mind-boggling to me, to dust off an old phrase, that that wrongdoing wasn't a factor in certification eligibility in the past. That you could do anything pretty much and get away with it. In terms of getting a job somewhere else, if you are disciplined by your employer, or if you're not disciplined by your employer, because you still have a job, right? I'm not sure if that is the best precedent, but I am glad for the outcome.
Well, I guess we're just gonna have to wait and see, but nonetheless, it seems to parallel more having people with learned experience on the oversight bodies that we are just talking about with, let's say, regards to homelessness too. So
yeah, and goodness knows that in terms of homelessness, homeless and formerly homeless rarely get a seat at the table. So I can see both sides on that one.
Yeah,
I do think that number one, it's ridiculous that officers can, kill somebody, and it's gone through the court system, and courts have, say a lawsuit has been settled if it's a civil case or if it's a criminal case, since that's possible now in the state of Washington, that wouldn't be a factor in whether to continue certification of a law enforcement officer. That seems ridiculous, but not surprising given law enforcement officers have pretty much been able to write their own tickets, so to speak, in terms of crafting those oversight bodies or crafting those laws. They almost always have law enforcement officers or former law enforcement officers staffing those agencies, and that's a problem. So definitely having community members involved, I think, is a step forward. It's just it's the crime victims aspect of it that gives me a little bit of pause, but It's a welcome corrective, put it that way.
Well, and the commission has been made up of significant number of police officers. In fact, yes. the in the 14-4 vote, the four who voted against it were all police officers. So
I'm shocked on them,
including and/or prosecutors. Dan Satterberg was one of the people that voted against it. So. Okay, and I believe Dan Satterberg is retiring soon.
Yes, he is. All
right. Well,
former Republican.
Speaking of police officers, Taylor Soper at GeekWire reported this week that Carmen Best has joined Microsoft as Director of Global Security Risk Operations.
And I'll bet she is getting paid a lot for that position, although, of course, Microsoft doesn't publish salaries. Remember that Best timed her resignation in 2020 so that she would be eligible for, SPD pension and at a higher level. So she's financially secure now, probably for life at this point. And, good for her, I guess. I'm not sure that she has any private sector experience at all. So that experience may be something of a shock for her. But she has been, peddling herself as a national expert for the last 2 years while she looks for work, or a year and a half. While she looks for work, she applied famously for the New York City police chief job. She was a finalist for that, somewhat inexplicably. The fact that those texts are still missing, and in theory anyway, she should have some criminal liability for that, doesn't seem to give Microsoft any pause at all.
Well, sticking one last item related to police, Capitol Hill Seattle blog reported this week that the Seattle police were approved for $2.3 million in Homeland Security and training equipment, including new vehicle barriers, body armor, and tactical robots. Included in the $2.3 million in line items signed off by the council this week are SBD plans to purchase equipment, including $175,000 for advanced ballistic protection armor for active shooter response, $300,000 in readily deployable vehicle barricades to be used to protect soft target locations, and $160,000 for a binocular night vision system enhanced clip-on thermal imager, which I know
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, I know everybody has had those on their Christmas wish lists for years now. And the I think the most controversial item was plans for two regional tactical robots, which one will deploy with Seattle and the other one will be going to Tacoma. The robots are equipped with manipulator arms and firing circuits and can assist with opening doors, searching, placing charges, and providing situational awareness through audio and video feeds.
Wait a minute. Placing charges? Aren't these supposed to be on the good guys' side? As opposed to, you know, stopping terrorists because they might plot a charge or something.
Theoretically, I believe the firing circuits supposedly are to be used for to remotely detonate charges placed to gain entry into an area by a robot. So, so blowing through a door or a wall, I guess, to get the robot in so it can.
Because that happens so often.
Why just the other day?
Yeah. Now it has been over 20 years since 9/11, and that is when the trend of militarizing local police departments came into vogue. And since then, we've been getting these gifts of former military hardware going to local police departments from Department of Homeland Security. And I will say this is a positive development, and this is the first time I can remember that we actually found out what the line items were. In the past, the SPD and other local agencies have been incredibly reluctant, even in the face of FOIA requests. I know I was trying to track that down for an article for Seattle Magazine some years ago, and I could not get anywhere with SPD to tell me what they were getting from the feds. So I guess that's a positive development, but it would be an even more positive development if we weren't getting these gifts at all.
Yeah, and I think the only reason we have details on this is because since it went through city council, they had to approve it. There was talked about it a couple different public safety committee hearings.
Yeah, so, and I believe that was a measure that that the city council passed a couple of years ago, you know, in the wake of all the George Floyd protests, that they wanted the details on this because they weren't getting the information either. And SPD, remember there was that dust up a few years ago about surveillance cameras that they were getting from the feds? In the wake of that, I believe also, city council decided that now maybe we need to know what these guys are getting and how they're going to use it. So, that's a positive development.
Yeah, I think it was a combination between the surveillance cameras that were put up and then eventually turned off, at least by last reports that I had seen. But yeah. And also the drones that Seattle PD had acquired and caused.
Oh, yeah.
And those were eventually then sold to the Los Angeles Police Department, was my
opinion. Oh, great.
So
I'm sure they'll use them much more responsibly.
No doubt. I'm sure they're probably been replaced by much more modern drones by now.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Moving on. intriguing article this week in the South Seattle Emerald by Kristen Harris Talley, talking about her experiences in the legislature.
Yeah, and she is she did it in the context of announcing that after one term in the state house, she is not going to run for re-election. She's representing the 23rd district in Southeast Seattle, and it was pretty scathing talking about her experience in Olympia and how she really couldn't get anywhere trying to represent constituents. Now, I had sort of mixed feelings about the article. And I want to say that in the context that I really like Kristen Harris Talley. And I thought she would make an outstanding legislator. And I'm kind of sad that she decided not to run for re-election, although I understand the reasons why. And, you know, she's I believe, got kids she wants to spend more time with, and that I'm sure is genuine. But she was also really, really frustrated with the legislative process. And I was, you know, this is in the context of, well, when she ran in 2019 and 2020, did she ever talk to a legislator about what the job actually entails? Did she actually ascertain that she wanted this job? Because legislative jobs in a lot of ways suck. There are a lot of mind-numbing details. And in Olympia in particular, it's a very sclerotic process. It can take years to get a particular measure through the legislature. And this is almost entirely a function of our archaic 19th century state constitution, which mandates 60-day sessions in 1 year and 90-day sessions in budget years. This means that legislators and their limited staff have to consider literally thousands of bills, and goodness knows Marie and I have talked about this over the years, thousands of bills in the course of, in the case this year, a 60-day session. Now, it's almost impossible for those bills to get a serious hearing, and the reason bills fail often isn't a function of whether it's a good idea or not. It's a function of whether you've got the right legislators to prioritize it, to push it through. Because it has to go through committees, it has to go through both houses, et cetera, et cetera. It has to be prioritized. And in the case of representing constituents, that's particularly difficult because constituents don't have paid lobbyists who are down there full time during a legislative session. And those are the people usually who can get legislators to prioritize an issue. But even then, it takes paid lobbyists years to get something that they want to see happen, prioritized and passed. If it's something that a legislator is trying to push themselves, particularly one that does not have a lot of committee seniority, as Harris Tully didn't, it's going to take a long time, much more than one term. And anybody who has even been around the legislature, much less served in it, could have told her that, you know, a couple of years ago before she ran. So I'm sad that she's not running for re-election because I think that she would, had she taken the time to master that process, she would have been outstanding on behalf of 23rd District legislative constituents. But she also has to take care of herself, and, you know, that's good, and she will. She will go back to community activism, which she enjoys and which she is very, very good at. So I'm looking forward to seeing what she does in that respect. The Southeast Seattle needs a new state representative now. And we'll see who runs for the office for the primary in August.
And as we talked about last week, there's, you know, 20 seats currently open from all the people that are bailing on the legislature.
Yeah, and I think some of it is people's frustration with that process and the expectation that is the legislature is a part-time job, which is ridiculous. It is a full-time, you know, 365-day-a-year job at this point because it's a huge budget. It's running the state. And the state is no longer this, you know, quaint pioneer farming outpost It's a, you know, modern multi-billion dollar economy, that needs that kind of engagement. And it's just not allowed by the state constitution. It's a bottleneck that determines almost everything in the legislature. And during the legislative session, you know, if you're a legislative aide, you are living out of a hotel room, usually in Olympia, and you are not sleeping, basically, because there's so much work, and it's impossible to manage.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. Big deal with Amazon workers at Staten Island this week, voting for
to
unionize.
And voting to unionize, despite the fact that, you know, there have been seven or eight various warehouses around the country that have attempted to unionize in the past, most famously in Alabama over the past couple of years. They've had multiple attempts because the NLRB keeps insisting on running the election again, and Amazon keeps doing the same tactics, which is to say spending millions of dollars per election to try and dissuade workers from joining a union. That happened here too. What made Staten Island different were a couple of things. Number one, you may remember early in the pandemic in the spring of 2020, where they fired a worker for speaking out about the lack of public health precautions that were afforded workers in that particular warehouse. That got a lot of national press, and it also influenced a lot of workers there that they needed collective bargaining. Now, this is it's only a step to authorize a union to negotiate on their behalf. It doesn't mean that that there's a contract yet. They still have to negotiate that, and I can't imagine that Amazon is going to be a willing partner in those negotiations. So we'll have to keep an eye on that to see how that goes. But the workers voted by more than 10%. The 2,654 2,131 against. And, you know, Amazon was doing things like putting big vote no banners in the workplace, you know, bringing in speakers to talk about why unions are inherently evil, et cetera. And classic union busting techniques, or in this case, trying to prevent union from getting a foothold at all. And it didn't work. And this is something that we're seeing in not just Amazon, but workplaces across the country. You've got a new generation of mostly young, BIPOC workers who are seeing how poorly corporations are treating workers and how much power they have over workers' lives, and you know, saying, "We need to speak with a collective voice on this." And it's a very encouraging trend. We saw a lot of labor actions last fall that were by and large successful. Places like Kellogg's and some of the meatpacking plants and some of the other strikes that got a lot of national attention. This has been a trend, and it's reversing really about a 70-year steady decline in union membership across the country. You know, from the heyday of the 40s and 50s, really in the wake of Taft-Hartley, which really needs to be repealed. Congress never does, but this is something that progressives and labor activists have been calling for many, many years. So yeah, this is a trend. It'll be interesting to see if this inspires workers at other Amazon facilities, like the ones in Seattle, where the stories of mistreatment by their employer are legion and longstanding. I'm not talking about the corporate people. I'm talking about the people in the warehouses, delivery drivers, contract workers. There's a lot of people who don't get paid very much by Amazon for doing what they do, And it's very hard work under very stressful conditions. So be interesting to see if that movement spreads here. Seattle is really an outlier in terms of the rest of the country, where the labor movement here has always been pretty strong. Mostly thanks to, you know, some major employers that are unionized, Boeing, public agencies, et cetera. So, we'll see if it spreads. I hope it does.
Yeah, there was a labor writer who tweeted online saying it's a great time to be a labor writer. In terms of historically, and my first thought on that was, well, but historically the number of labor writers has been again paralleling the reduction in unions has gone down dramatically from what it used to be by corporate media choosing to push them out and focus instead on, you know, pro-corporate PR type writers instead. So
yeah, if you go back, even corporate media 70, 80 years ago, if you go back in the old microfiche, had labor sections. Now they have business sections. Mm-hmm. Which serve primarily to pass on information to people who own stocks. It is generally does not represent the interests or concerns of the people who actually do the work. So that has been a total sea change over the past several generations. Even corporate media that used to pay attention to labor issues no longer do.
Okay, one last positive item, which we don't generally include very many of in the week. Courtney Flatt at KUOW reported yesterday that a judge rules against Navy SEAL training at Washington State parks. And it's interesting that about a year ago –
We're not talking about the marine mammals.
Oh, yes, you're correct. Yeah, no, Navy SEALs are
they're notoriously difficult to train.
In January 2021, the Washington State Parks and Recreation Commission had voted 4-3 to approve the Navy's proposal to use up to 28 parks for training purposes, where supposedly SEALs would emerge from the water under the cover of darkness and disappear into the environment. And a lot of people were not happy with that proposal.
How can they disappear into the environment? Because I'm pretty sure they're not biodegradable.
Well, the equipment's not biodegradable, but, you know, and depending on how much toxins you eat, perhaps the rest of you isn't biodegradable either. But anyway, there was pushback at the time, and it kind of dropped off the radar, and a judge this week on Friday ruled against it. Judge in Thurston County ruled against it. He had some harsh words to say about it. I don't have them here in front of me. But anyway, very interesting development.
But trust us, they were harsh. And yeah, it's like how many terrorists are lurking in Seattle's state parks or Washington State state parks? It just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, well, I think they're just looking for exotic locations that apparently they can't find on any of the large, numerous bases that the military already has in Washington State. You know, they're poor.
Or on those bases, the environment has already been so despoiled that it's not suitable for training.
Could be. I mean, there is a understanding that military bases themselves are notorious for environmental toxins and pollution that, you know, take decades. Once they abandon the base, take friggin' decades to clean up as Superfund sites.
Yeah, no, the military is the biggest polluter in the country by far.
Yeah. All right, we got to move along. This week's
okay.
COVID news.
On to the bad news. new cases are up 70% in King County only in the past week. They've nearly doubled, since the beginning of March. This is with the new, BA.2 subvariant. And, it also comes, Remember on, I believe the 12th of March was when the state mask mandate for indoor spaces, was dropped. And while King County, you've got some people who are still wearing masks and, you've got, a very, very high vaccination rate compared to pretty much anywhere else in the country. But it's not clear whether those vaccines are still effective because the number of people who've actually gotten boosters is relatively low, somewhere around a third. So these are ideal conditions, as we've learned over the past couple of years, for the reemergence of a new wave, and that is exactly what is happening. And I hate to say I told you so, but I've been telling you so pretty consistently every week. For the past couple of years, every time we get on the backside of a wave, in this case of Omicron, and declare that, well, the pandemic is over now, everybody can go back to lives as normal, which the remembering what actually is normal, that is not in a pandemic, is a receding memory at this point, because, you know, it's been over 2 years now that we've been dealing with COVID-19. The 19 stands for 2019 when it was first emerged, and then we're now in 2022. But the pandemic is not over, and I know this sounds like a broken record because it runs counter to the public messaging. I saw Jeff Duchin, the head of Seattle King County Public Health, was on KOW really downplaying this latest spike. And I'm not sure why, because this the BA2 subvariant is even more transmissible than the original Omicron variant was. It is just as deadly, which is not as likely to cause serious health issues as the Delta variant or the original virus, but you can be asymptomatic or you can have relatively mild symptoms and still wind up in about a third of all cases with long COVID. And that is something that is playing havoc with a lot of people's lives. And scientists still don't understand why exactly some people get long COVID and others don't. What causes it? There are a lot of different symptoms that go with it, including extreme fatigue, what is called brain fog. And there was a study out this past week that showed striking similarities at the cellular level between that and chemo brain, which is a well-known side effect of chemotherapy. It's a mystery at this point, but it is extremely debilitating for a lot of people, and that is still spreading in the community, and spreading much more rapidly than it was even a week ago. So continue to take precautions, social distance, don't go into crowded indoor spaces without a mask or two, wearing a mask or two, not just having it in your pocket, and continue to be cautious. It's a relatively small cost that can prevent a whole lot of misery down the road. So, and not that far down the road. So, we are still in the midst of a pandemic. We still have to act accordingly. I know people are really tired of it, but, maybe this will be the time when the message actually sticks. I'm not optimistic on that score. I think cases are going to continue to go up throughout April and maybe into May. And we're seeing that trend across the country as well. It's not just King County or Washington State that's seeing it. Meantime, in Washington, a couple major developments this week. The federal government, believe it or not, launched a website called COVID.gov, which enables people to find out what the pandemic restrictions, if any, are in their own communities and where they can get treatment. That's particularly important because we're starting to see treatment costs which have been free throughout the pandemic, that the funding for that has expired now in a lot of cases. Senators are nearing a deal to try and move a stalled aid package that the Biden administration has wanted for COVID-19. They're cutting it now to $10 billion from the original $15 billion, as they work to break a log jam that's been caused by Republicans complaining that we can't spend all that we don't want to spend all that money on trying to save people's lives. That is your modern Republican Party, and that is why it has not passed so far, unfortunately. And, you know, the only way to fix that is by electing more non-Republican senators. Let's see, what else? The FDA this week authorized fourth booster shots for anybody over the age of 50, as well as immunocompromised people and immunosuppressed people of all ages. So that would be good news. And that should there's plenty of vaccine available now at this point, because the demand for it has dropped off over the past several months. So if you have not gotten a second booster shot, you probably should be after 4 or more months since your original booster shot, or if you haven't had any boosters at all, start that process. It really does prevent more serious cases, and it also provides a lot more protection against Omicron than the original two shots if you took Pfizer or Moderna, or one shot if you took Johnson & Johnson. And that is our bad news pandemic update for the week.
All right. Okay, moving on. Developments with the January 6th investigation coming
out? Yeah, a lot of different developments this week, and I think people are tending to tune that out now because it's been so long and because we have not seen any serious accountability for people who were at the planning level. This week saw some encouraging signs in that case. The DOJ has widened its January 6th investigation to include planners of the event rather than just the people who stormed the Capitol. Now, why that didn't happen months ago is anybody's guess, but it is a positive development nonetheless. We saw a 7-hour gap in the call log of the White House on the day of January 6th. In other words, the log of who Donald Trump was on the phone to. And now bear in mind that Richard Nixon in a half century ago was forced to resign over an 18-minute gap in his calls. This is 7 hours where we don't know who Donald Trump was talking to, what he was saying, and that stuff is normally recorded. It's recorded for record keeping, for posterity. And apparently that information has all been wiped, probably by the Trump administration, probably before they left office. That is not a good sign. And we saw a release by the January 6th House Committee, the Select Committee, of text by Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, in which he made reference to POTUS, that is to say Donald Trump, while he was president, being involved in the planning process for storming the Capitol on January 6th to try and interrupt the certification of the election. This is pretty damning, and it's the sort of thing, in order to prosecute Trump on this particular charge of the many he could be prosecuted for, you have to show an awareness that he was not only involved in the planning, but that it was conscious. There's a legal term for it that I'm forgetting at the moment. But this is the sort of thing that judges and juries have to consider in order to find Trump guilty. Now, that still requires the Department of Justice to draw charges. And of course, you know, deciding to file charges against a former president, let alone, you know, getting it to trial, over the inevitable, delay tactics that I'm sure Trump's lawyers would employ, let alone that he would probably sue and it would probably go to the Supreme Court because it would be appealed and he would be hoping there to get his handpicked Supreme Court to throw it out. There's still a lot of steps to bring any kind of accountability to our by far most criminal president. And I say that inviting the Trump people to go ahead and sue me. Because the discovery process would be a lot of fun. And I'm sure I could find lawyers who would be happy to take that on. So, some encouraging steps on the long, long, long road to accountability for an attempted overthrow of the United States government and installing Trump as a permanent president for life dictator, which he still aspires to that, apparently. Certainly, his rhetoric and the indication that he's raising large amounts of money for a 2024 run. And, you know, I really can't imagine what record he would run on. Yeah, I killed 500,000 people during the pandemic and set in process the model of devolving all responsibility from the feds to the states. Which is really the original sin in terms of how the United States has handled the pandemic and the reason that we are far and away the worst hit country in the world. Because, you know, half of the states are being run by anti-science Republicans who really didn't want to take any kind of steps to stop the pandemic. And for that, the virus thanks you. Another good news item, or several good news items, actually. I'm just not sure how much we can stand all this good news.
All right. Well, a lot of that yet to materialize, though.
That's true. Potential good news.
Okay. All right. Moving on, California and reparations.
Yeah, California is really the only state so far that is seriously looking at the issue of reparations for African Americans who have suffered in terms of generational wealth from the after effects of slavery. It established a task force on reparations. They voted on Tuesday to limit state compensation to the descendants of free and enslaved black people who were in the United States in the 19th century. It narrowly rejected a proposal to include all black people, regardless of lineage. Now, this is something that has actually split the pro-reparations movement, even though reparations themselves have been getting much more serious consideration in the past few years after. That kind of proposal has been around for many, many years. But the case in favor of reparations is really pretty compelling. When you look at, wealth that has passed from generation to generation, the after effects of slavery are very real in the 21st century, where you have, taken collectively. African Americans have far less wealth than white Americans or other racial groups, for that matter, even Latinos or Asians. Really, Native Americans are the only comparably affected peoples, and they should be getting reparations too, honestly, for, you know, their ancestors having been all but wiped off the face of the earth. there is this schism within the pro-reparations movement as to whether, all blacks should be included in that, because they're all affected by racism, obviously, or whether you have to limit it to only people who are part of and can demonstrate that their forebears were enslaved, which is to say, as opposed to people who have immigrated from other parts of the world sometime in the last 150 years. So That split unfortunately doomed this proposal. And so, the outcome of it was that, the state of California, if it does enact some kind of reparations, proposal, it will be limited strictly to folks who can, you know, go on Ancestry.com and prove that's where their ancestors came from. So, or that's what that they have that kind of history in their family's past. So, unfortunate development, in a lot of ways, but, it is encouraging that California is actually taking it seriously.
All right. I want to jump to, international, if we could, to make sure we have time to talk about
you. Sure. Sure, sure. Well, it was another, eventful week in the war in Ukraine. Early in the week, Ukrainian President Zelensky, indicated that Ukraine was ready to discuss neutrality and, which is to say, the prospect of permanently promising not to join NATO. This in the wake of, I think a fourth round of negotiations between Russian and Ukrainian delegates in Turkey on potential peace talks, or at least ceasefire talks. Now the problem with this, of course, is that even if Russia agrees to something, there is very little confidence in most quarters that they would actually honor the agreement. We've seen that in terms of the temporary ceasefire agreements that Russia has agreed to allow humanitarian aid to reach besieged cities like Mariupol, where Russia then turns around and shells the convoys that try to get into the city. That has continued to happen. And we're seeing people in the city of Mariupol now who are literally starving to death or becoming so dehydrated that they fall extremely ill because there's no food and water. Because Russia has not allowed that kind of aid to come into the city. People who are dependent on medications are not getting those medications. So there's serious health problems, health consequences as well from that aspect. And the city of Mariupol itself really no longer exists. It has been totally destroyed by repeated shelling by Russian, forces day after day after day. Now, early in the week, and I think I actually mentioned this last weekend, that, Russian general, yes, because it was a week ago Friday that happened, a Russian general indicated that Russia was going to pull back from, particularly, places in northern, Ukraine where they've not been able to make any progress, such as trying to encircle the city of Kiev, that they were going to try and pull back and just focus their efforts on eastern Ukraine and protecting the breakaway provinces of the Donbass. Well, pay attention to what they do, not what they say. There has been some progress this week on the ground in that happening. The Russian forces have been retreating from the capital city of Kiev, but they have been laying mines all over in civilian areas on the way out. So that, for example, laying mines around corpses that are left rotting in the streets so that they cannot be retrieved. In a perverse sense, this is kind of encouraging because it means that the Russians probably are not planning to come back, at least not in that direction. And of course, this is, you know, war criminal type behavior, as has been much of the invasion. The shelling of places like Kiev and Lviv and Kharkiv, which is another city that's all but destroyed, has continued this week. They are not slowing down with that particular tactic. And in fact, the types of bombs that they're using have been getting steadily larger and more deadly. So we're still seeing a lot of bombardment of Ukrainian cities. Assuming this war ends, and a lot of experts think it's likely to drag on for months, it's going to be an incredibly difficult building reprocess for Ukraine as a nation. Watch what they do, not what they say. Russia says they're retreating, but so far there's been, very little difference on the ground between current and past behavior, with the exception of the mine laying in the past couple of days. Meanwhile, Joe Biden got a lot of flack about this time last week for saying that Vladimir Putin, quote, cannot remain in power. Now, the White House backtracked on that, insisting that, no, he wasn't calling for a regime change. He was just talking about it on a moral level, that this guy's really got to go. But, you know, most people didn't take it that way. Russia certainly didn't take it that way. You know, I if you remember, the United States prior to the invasion was leaking intelligence information. Yeah, Russia is trying to planning to do this, planning to do that, false flag operations, etc. That probably prevented those operations from taking place. This suggests that the CIA or some intelligence agency has moles planted within Vladimir Putin's inner circle. And given that the consequence of being discovered in that role would probably be a quick and painful death, or a slow and painful death, surely somebody in that role is willing to lay down their life and take out Vladimir Putin. So the White House can deny it all they want, but that was almost certainly some sort of a signal in the sense of, Russia, are you listening? So we'll see what happens. Putin is notoriously security conscious, even against COVID. And, we saw, several very high profile, infections, including pretty much the entire communication shop within the Biden administration this week, that tested positive for COVID. So, and Hillary Clinton did too. So, maybe Putin is smart to be that security conscious. But, the war shows no signs of letting up at this point. 4.1 million Ukrainians now have left the country. That's 1/10 of the population of Ukraine before the war started has now fled the country. There's also a lot of effort going also into the humanitarian effort to try and resettle those refugees. The United States announced early in the week that it would accept 100,000 of those refugees, which sounds like a lot. It isn't. It's, 1/40th and counting of the number of refugees that are actually coming out of Ukraine. The United States itself, its population is roughly equivalent to all of Europe. So that was definitely not showing much leadership from the United States, but is, consistent with our attitude toward refugees as a whole and immigrants as a whole. I was disappointed to see that, that number was limited. And the wait at U.S. embassies to actually get processed for that extends for months. Sometimes up to 6 months in the case of, Hungary and Romania. It's 4 months, I believe, in Poland right now. So those refugees are having to cool their heels in European countries and wade through, an extremely complex set of paperwork and documentation when they literally left sometimes just with the clothes on their back and with the stuff into a suitcase. It's very unfortunate that the U.S. is taking that kind of approach. They are trying to add consular staff so they can handle applications in a more timely basis. But it's a very slow and, as I said, complicated process.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we've got for this week.
All right. Well, we'll do it again next week.
There's always next week.
We're back with more great news.